Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Dean Mackin on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And g'day and welcome to Friday. Don't you love Fridays? I absolutely love Fridays. This Friday, a little bit less than normal because it's going to be my last Friday here for a while. I'm going to miss you a lot. Off to do other things, back to the IT world for a while. I may be back. I may be doing something on the weekends. I'll talk with management about that. But just wanted to say thank you to the management at TNT. What a professional organization. This is how wonderful it's been to work here for now coming up on about a year. And I've really enjoyed it. And all of you in the chat that participate almost feels like family in the online chat of an afternoon, getting to, even though we don't get to reply to every comment we see, we certainly do read them all as we go through the program. So absolutely enjoying it. And what better guest could I have today than the guy who got me the job here in the first place, Senator Malcolm Roberts, who referred me to management because we'd been speaking for a long time at other places that I'd worked in the past. And Senator Malcolm Roberts put his hand up and said, "Why don't you get Dean Mackin on the onto your radio station?" And they subsequently did. So terrific to be here. We'll be talking to Senator Malcolm Roberts and to Professor Ted Steele a little bit later in the program as well. Now, if you saw the news headlines, you people over there in the UK, and the term Indigenous may not be mean too much to you. You probably don't hear it because it would mean you. It would be advocating for you. Here in Australia, we get the term Indigenous rubbed in our faces all the time. It represents less than 4% of the community, many of those people only being part Indigenous, some less than 50%. And I would advocate that is not really Indigenous at all. And for those who are less than 50% Indigenous, who don't like the people or their treatment in the past, maybe you should look at yourself because you are in part responsible for that as well. But let's get past that. If I had a headline and if I was Rupert Murdoch, who, by the way, is getting remarried, can you believe that? He's got 6 kids already. Now, this woman that he is marrying, she's 67. But if you Google her name, Alina Zhukova, 90% of the photos in the media of a much younger Alina Zhukova, because they want you to think that she's like 30 or 40 years of age, and Rupert Murdoch at 92, and, you know, respect, Rupert, if you can still do what you need to do at 92, all power to you. I don't know how you do it, but he somehow manages. But he's getting married, and he's been married a bunch of times, 5, if my memory serves me correctly. But Rupert Murdoch getting out there, punching well above his weight, unless, of course, you're looking at the bank account, in which case he's probably punching down significantly. But Alina Zhukova is in it just for love. Just for love. What's not to love, Rupert? Or Rupret. I like to call him Rupert. Have you ever seen the movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels with Steve Martin and Michael Caine? It's very good. You should check it out. But I'm sure it's because she loves you, Rupert. Rupert. I'm absolutely sure of that. And the kids, I wonder if the kids are happy. Less for the kids at 92. They probably already had the money all sorted out and divvied up. Now they're going to have to reevaluate. But getting back to my story, because Rupert Murdoch owns a bunch of newspapers. Now, of course, if I was Rupert Murdoch, what I would be doing is having a headline when it comes to Sam Kerr, who plays for Chelsea FC, women's soccer. Anyone watching? Anyone? Bueller? Probably nobody. And how do I know that? Because I work in pubs and clubs quite a bit. And when the men's football is on, you may as well not be there. Everyone's watching the TV. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of entertainment or the level of it you put on, you just don't even bother when the footy's on. But when the women's sports are on, and I'm not just saying this, I'm not being sexist, I'm just being observant, nobody cares. Literally, you could have the female state of origin, which is huge in the male. I mean, forget even putting an event on, like any kind of entertainment, when you have state of origin. It is the entertainment. Every person is in the pub or has gone to the pub just to watch it. When we have the female state of origin, literally, you may as well just turn the TV off. Nobody cares. And if you do see somebody watching, I typically go up and say, "Are you the sister, the cousin, or the auntie?" Because it typically is someone who knows one of the players. And I'm not exaggerating because I've actually done that a couple of times. And whilst it wasn't a sister, cousin, or auntie, I went to school with that one or something along those lines. So you do get that from time to time, probably more often than one might think. Anyway, the headline would read, you know, Chelsea FC, Sam Kerr's racial slur against Indigenous man. Indigenous man. He is an Indigenous man. He is a man. He is a white man. And he is in the UK, a police officer who was called some sort of name, but basically a white bastard or something from memory. In this article, I cannot see the actual claim, but the simple fact is it was racial, it was skin colour based. And there you are, Sam Kerr, making racial slurs against Indigenous people in the UK where you are a guest, but of course the Australian here, one of our newspapers, if you want to call it that, online. I don't think they sell any papers. No one's doing that anymore. They said that the courts are choked with unnecessary or problematic prosecution. All of this occurs while the UK faces a spike in violent offending. But of course, if this was a white person making a racial slur against an Indigenous person here in Australia, it would be all over the Australian's front page, and they would be advocating that this person be stood down, this person be sacked, this person not be a part of the Australian soccer team or football team, as you call it over there in the UK. And I would completely, the hypocrisy. It is all one-way traffic on this street, and the moves, the wheels turn, move very slowly of justice, because she only just received the summons in the mail earlier this year for an event that took place a year ago. It's not going to be up for a preliminary hearing until, I believe, next month or the month after, and it's not going to go to court for trial until February of next year. So, wow. I say kick her out, send her back. Not that we want her here in Australia, and not that you would know that if you read the mainstream news, because they are telling you that everybody is on her side and it's no big deal. Well, I can tell you, if you go onto x.com or facebook.com before your posts are deleted, everybody is saying pretty much what I'm saying, and a very small but overly vocal minority are advocating for her, because apparently, and you know what? I would say it is okay to call somebody white. I would suggest it is, because we wear it as a badge of honor. So I don't see, but the problem is, if you can't call us, if I can't call somebody black in a certain way, why should they be able to call us white in that same manner that it was intended? You get what I'm saying? It's all one-way traffic. Now, for all of the latest community events, rallies, marches, festivals, and fundraisers happening near you, then visit the What's On Events calendar on the TNT Radio website. Help us to stay in touch here at today's News Talk TNT.
Talk that matters.
For once, we just need to do what's best for this damn country and not what's best for the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Gemma Cooper, how are you?
Well, I'm a little saddened and distressed hearing your opening editorial there. Firstly, I've really enjoyed working with you, Dean, and comparing all of the likes and similarities and often lockstep between the UK and Australia, because it's early hours for me in the morning. And, you know, just hearing that it's driving towards the end of the day in Australia, everyone's heading towards the evening and thinking about winding down, and we're winding up. But often there are so many similarities between our two countries. So I'll miss you. I will. I'll absolutely miss you. But I'm also a bit distressed because you painted a picture in my head there of Rupert Murdoch at 92 still doing what he needs to do. I don't really want that in my head on a Friday morning, but put it there, I'm afraid.
I learned a long time ago, when I say something, I never visualize it, I never picture it, and I forget that a lot of people do. So I should be wary of that when I do that. But Rupert at 92, I mean, miracles continue to happen, it would seem.
I think your astute analysis of the bank balance has probably got a lot to do with that. And, it's a real story, that one of hope over experience, isn't it? Wife number five. I'm sure this is the one. This is definitely the one. This is the love of my life at 92. So you've had a good go. So, yeah, you know what? Life is for living. I've got my own opinions on Murdoch, on the Murdoch family, the Murdoch dynasty. But, you know, he's still in the game. Why not? Why not? Life's for living, isn't it?
Well, it's all about love, I'm sure. I have absolutely no doubt. And if you believe that, you'll believe anything. all power to him. But I dare say that the six kids probably not overly impressed. They probably had all the money already divvied up, and they'll have to do a bit of re-divvying, one might imagine.
Possibly, very, very possibly. And I wonder if Jerry Hall, his last wife, the supermodel, former supermodel, she'll have a few things to say, I'm sure. But there we go. Anyway, on to the final story that we'll be covering together. This is another legacy of our budget this week in the UK, which has had immense fallout because it's an election budget. And there are more kind of drip feeds and revelations about how this really is having a knock-on effect to the entire UK population. And this is another policy that really, you know, and Jeremy Hunt, our Chancellor, has announced this £10 billion tax cut package to woo voters. Some may be saying we might even have a May general election. And lots of people have said, well, where are you going to find the money? And this today is a headline that is an example of where he's finding this money to offset this huge tax cuts package. He's winding down a scheme, and we've got a housing crisis in England, as you have in Australia. So he's winding down a scheme that delivered £200 million a year to social housing in the UK and enabled people to have somewhere affordable to live. It's all tied up with the scheme we have in England, which is the right to buy council houses if you've lived there for a certain amount of time. A council house is a house provided by the local authority, owned by the local authority, and normally people would rent it. But under Margaret Thatcher, years ago, you had the right to buy. That came in. And if you lived there for a certain amount of time and paid a certain amount of rent, you got it slightly cheaper. And it enabled people on low incomes to get a property of their own and get on the ladder and move on up and then free up the house for someone else. 25% of revenue from council house sales used to be funneled off into central government, and the local authority would keep the rest, 75%. Last year, in an attempt to boost social housing, because we've got such a crisis, the government said, we won't take that 25%. You keep everything, local authority councils, and on local grassroots level, you can keep that 25% worth between 180 million and 200 million. You keep that, reinvest it in social housing, which will help with the housing crisis. That was supposed to go on for 2 years. In the budget this week, the Chancellor said, no, we're stopping that. We want the 25% back, because obviously they're going to use that 200 million to pay for these tax cuts. Local authorities are absolutely apoplectic because many of them have already gone bankrupt, and they were relying on this extra chunk of cash that they didn't normally get to see them through a very, very difficult year. Some local councils this morning are warning of civil unrest now due to the level of cuts and savings they're going to have to make. Two councils this week voted on emergency cuts to take them through this financial year coming up in April, and they're stringing, really strident cuts affecting the most vulnerable. And this, on top of that, taking away this extra revenue, which was being directly funneled back into social housing in a time where we have a housing crisis, is yet another blow. So councils today warning of civil unrest. We're not a country renowned for civil unrest. It takes a lot to get the average Brit, you know, off the sofa, away from the TV, away from their allotments and gardens, and out onto the streets. But it really is an example of broken Britain. The Chancellor wanted to deliver a real, you know, election winning budget, but all of these, you know, he's having to rob the poor to pay for tax cuts for those more well off, and everyone's seeing through it this morning. It's a bit of a dismal headline to end the week, but that's where we are in Britain on a Friday today.
It really is horrific. It's more horrific when you put it into perspective, and that perspective being that whilst they have no money for any of that, they've got plenty of money to send across to the Ukraine to go and pick a fight with Russia. It is beyond horrific, and it goes on again in lockstep, absolutely, here in Australia. America, even worse, one might imagine. But Gemma, I don't know when the people are just going to wake up and only vote for those who will fix this place, because we've had this duopoly, you know, this uni party in for so long now in both our countries, and they just continue to ruin our country at a rate of knots. In fact, not just ruin it, it looks like some sort of engineering to destroy our country. I can't look at it as anything else, and the evidence is all around us.
It's certainly, this one is a definite ploy to take from the vulnerable, because if you're in a position where you need social housing or you need a council house, by definition, you don't have a lot of money. You could well be vulnerable, and the council will house you in what is now very limited council housing stock, because once the right to buy scheme came in under Thatcher, yes, it had its pluses because it enabled people who could no way near afford a house to get a house, but it took that council housing stock away from people who did also need it because of vulnerable issues, or, you know, families fleeing domestic violence, all kinds of things. There is less of that stock to go around. So taking that revenue away to invest in further stock the knock-on drip feed effect is to those at the bottom, those that are the most vulnerable, those that are the poor in the UK. And it's an easy hit. Now, Jeremy Hunt's team, the government, are saying, you know, it's not really a cut because it was just kind of a favour that they were doing local authorities. The local authorities see it very differently and saying, well, it might have been a favour to us, but 200 million is 200 million. And at the moment, we really, really need it. But the fact that they are warning of civil unrest, that's different from going to the ballot box and angrily putting your X in a different box. This is civil unrest. And, you know, local councils are local by definition. They're on a grassroots level. They see their you know, electorate coming in every day, asking for services, asking for help. They're seeing it on the ground, which Whitehall, ensconced in London, isn't. So for them to be now warning of civil unrest, it shows that there are rumblings in local communities. And I wonder what we will see this year as these budget cuts announced this week to, you know, really start to bite in the 2024-2025 financial year for the UK.
Yeah, very much unlike science, where you need to add something to the mix to make something blow up or explode. In society, all you need to do is take away the money, take away the food, and you'll have chaos. And absolutely, that is something that I think many of us would predict for the future. It's a prediction we'd all love to be wrong about. But the way society is heading with this division that is increasing, getting ramped up by the media and such, I just can't see it ending well. It's rather frightening. I mean, I've said to my son, I would advocate, you know, if you get some money, go and buy a big property off the grid out in the middle of nowhere for when society goes bang. And it's something I can see coming. It's something I think they've been working towards, the globalists, for a long, long time, trying to shut the Western nations down. So again, that moves other countries up in the mix. I could have a guess, and I've probably hinted at that over the last couple of weeks, but certainly not a terrific outcome for the world.
Well, if your son gets that off-grid property, I might come and join you. We'll form a big, you know, TNT-related commune and shut ourselves off from the matrix. There we go. That's my final parting shot and my final show with you, Dean. Love working with you.
The next time we meet, it could be in the bunker. Who knows? Isn't she wonderful? Gemma Cooper, thank you. I've enjoyed our time together, and hopefully we'll do it again at some point in the future. Take care. Everybody, coming up after the break, we're going to talk to the man who started all, who got me here, and a man who absolutely I would advocate should be the Prime Minister of Australia one day, Senator Malcolm Roberts of One Nation. He'll be coming up after the break right here at TNT.
TNT's Patrick Henningsen.
So you see what's happening here. The White House is doing heavy spring cleaning, deep clean, to expunge, to erase, to discredit. Believe it or not, even though this stuff has already been out, they're still trying to move to discredit any talk or any evidence or anything related to the Hunter Biden laptop story and also any Biden corruption in Ukraine. So their hand is being forced and they're not going to take this lying down. The White House certainly is not going to capitulate to any of these allegations or charges. The Republicans have been pushing forward, as everybody knows, with this House investigation, been getting very interesting traction. So now the deep state is moving into action to discredit any witnesses and to write it all off as Russian disinformation. Sound familiar? Have we been here before? Of course we have.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
My baby's back from the West Coast.
Hear those pictures that you asked for your school project? First day of school, cute as a button.
So long ago.
Oh, here's Grandma Florence. After that flood wiped out the whole neighborhood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Ah, those beans smell heavenly.
Mm-hmm. Give Mom a little credit.
You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year.
Oh, thank great you.
Idea. At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local I can send you with the link.
Okay.
Smart.
I'm coming to share with you guys.
Protect your legacy. Plan for natural disasters today. Visit ready.gov/plan.
Eggs. You can fry them, scramble them, poach them, boil them, or race them on a spoon. But uncooked eggs can be a risk for food poisoning. To be safe, avoid buying dirty or cracked eggs. Always wash your hands after handling eggs. And if you're concerned, pregnant, elderly, or have a poor immune system, make sure you cook eggs until the yolk starts to firm. Or look for new pasteurized eggs. For excellent eggs, handle them safely.
Plug in.
Website
TNTradio.live.
Check it out.
Today's news talk radio.
It's the coolest.
TNT.
And welcome back. We'll be talking to Malcolm Roberts, Senator Malcolm Roberts, in just a second. I was talking about electric vehicles, and I know I like to feed the monster. I know how much most of you hate electric cars. I've got to admit, I've driven one. It did like 0 to 100, and I think it was like 2.8 seconds as a test drive, and that was impressive. But the fact that I tend to travel, you know, between here and Queensland quite often for work, part of something that I'll be doing imminently as well. It's impractical. Can you imagine? I mean, I like getting into my Volkswagen twin turbo diesel, you know, V8, and just driving up there gets 1,000 kilometers to a 90 liter tank. It's terrific. I mean, why would I want to switch to electric vehicles? And if you read some of these, you know, if you've got a Tesla, you're free charging, great, terrific. But a lot of these people that are paying to charge their car, it's actually cheaper to run a small diesel vehicle than it is to go and run one of their EVs, to say nothing of the fact that that diesel engine will probably be good for at least 500,000 kilometers. And someone would buy that car with 500,000 kilometers knowing that that is the case. But the simple fact is those EVs will be worthless in 10 years. They will literally be, have a deficit value. You'd have to pay somebody to take them. What are you going to do with them? You know, the battery is going to be worth literally more than the car. Aston Martin, and they put the brakes on its new electric supercar until 2026 because people are saying that those people who buy supercars want the throaty roar of some sort of big V8 or high-powered turbo engine. That's what they want. But in response to that, in the UK, apparently half of learners want lessons in electric vehicles. And of course, if they don't have a clue, if you put them in a manual vehicle, they'd stare at the stick and say, what's that? Unless they kind of figured it out through watching one of the Fast and Furious movies. They would have no idea if it wasn't for someone like Vin Diesel, Paul Walker, or The Rock, one might imagine. And those people, we know they want the V8s or the turbos. The young kids like the turbos, but absolutely, it is just dreadful what's going on. I think we might have Malcolm Roberts. I'll wait for a voice in my ear to let me know when that is the case. But yeah, I mean, the governments are trying to push. This article, I'll just go on. A House of Lords committee report said electric car sales were stalling among private motorists and many cannot afford them because of the slow rollout of public chargers, particularly in rural areas. Now, if you live in a rural area, now let's forget rural. I live on the central coast of New South Wales. Every time I make a trip just to the next major town, if you will, Gosford, that is about 60 kilometres. I mean, that takes me 35 minutes to get there on the freeway. And I do that trip daily, everybody day. I do that trip in an electric vehicle. It would just be impractical. And sometimes I'm going backwards and forwards two or three, four times a day, delivering these things that we rent out. And quite often, if we're too busy, I have to jump in the van and do all of that. But it's just absolutely nuts what's going on. We're going to do a bit of a reorder today. We're going to talk to my next guest, who is Professor Ted Steele, somebody that I've had on the program before, who is absolutely phenomenal. And I'll just read his bio. So I'm just doing a bit of reordering here. He is a molecular and cellular immunologist, a geneticist, a microbiologist, and the author of 6 books and over 100 scientific papers. He's conducted research and taught at the Australian National University's John Curtin School of Medical Research and worked at the University of Toronto's Ontario Cancer Institute. The Wellcome Trust in the UK and the University of Wollongong. Professor Steele is CYO Connor, Foundation Life member, and he's a terrific fella, and he's right across pretty much everything when it comes to what's happened to us in the last 4 years. Welcome to the program, Professor Ted Steele.
Thank you very much, Dean.
Mate,
nice to be with you again, and I understand it's your last show, so, well, I hope everything, well, for the time being, and I hope everything goes well for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. I appreciate that, mate. I'm sure we'll meet up around the traps again, because once you've had a terrific guest like Professor Ted Steele, you tend to, if you stay in the media, to talk to terrific people such as him all the time. Mate, where would you like to start? Lots to talk about. I would like you just quickly comment. There's this new portable DNA and RNA sequence detection testing, amplifying signal systems, but we need to associate with clear symptoms. That part there, mate, I don't understand it. Could you explain it to me?
Yes, it's actually getting a lot of wide publicity in the biotechnology news sites, you know, around the globe, and I'm plugged into a few of those. So it's actually a big deal. So, but it's so highly, highly technical, and it's come on so fast, I can't really comment on its the actual technical steps, but I understand the principles. The principle is a molecular test which is very sensitive, which allows scientists to pick up DNA and RNA sequences specifically, like COVID, like other diseases that we might have. But that's the whole point, I suppose. And I'm not in any way casting any doubt on the biotech innovation. I'm certain, given the widespread coverage it's getting and the large numbers of authors and the type of documentation they've done in the scientific literature, it almost certainly is a very sensitive test for specific DNA and RNA sequences, a la, you know, picking up COVID, just like the PCR test did for COVID. And then later, like the rat test did, you know, the people got these small portable tests that they could test themselves. So, that, you know, the actual innovation and the whole thing driving it is quite noble. I've got no problem with that. The problem I had immediately seeing it, it was the way it was packaged, because that's the way they've got to sell it. I understand scientists in these biotechnology innovation situations have got to link it to something relevant like COVID or like the, you know, a Helicobacter pylori, the one, you know, the bug that that causes, you know, problems in the stomach, you know, ulcers, stomach ulcers. So I can understand that it's packaged, but the actual paper, when you look at it, it's a highly detailed technical paper. It's sort of far removed from that. So, but it alerts me to the way the packaging is going. You know, we've got away with it with COVID, so we can sell it. We can sell these principles with almost anything. And what was very disturbing with COVID, amongst all the very disturbing things that we, you know, we all were subjected to or witnessed, was it's a very highly sensitive test which was totally devoid of picking up symptoms. There were certainly, I think, severe cases in elderly, you know, comorbid people. But many people, if they got it at all, was probably mild or was undetectable, you know, asymptomatic. But nevertheless, the PCR test would have rendered them positive. And we know what that did to a lot of people. If you turned up PCR positive, you're in right at the height of the hysteria. You were impounded, locked down, you couldn't move around and all that sort of stuff. You had to isolate yourself. So that's the only disturbing feature about it. I'm not having a go at the technology. It's the way we use technology, and, you know, that was the disturbing thing through COVID. And one of the things that were driving the whole hysteria with COVID, particularly with the highly sensitive PCR test, was that it looked to be picking up a highly rampaging person-to-person spreading virus, didn't it? You know, during different epidemics and outbreaks in just in Australia, where we had the, you know, in New South Wales or Victoria. You know, the side was we had all these PCR positive tests, and gee, this is a really fast moving spreading virus, a rampaging virulent virus. It was never any of those things, by the way. And my argument of late has been to try and drive home to people that person to person spread, which was the overarching justification for testing, isolating people, blocking people, and all this, never really happened during any epidemic anywhere that emerged suddenly on the face of the earth. That's the problem. It looked like in nursing homes, aged care, and in small localized groups, you could certainly see things like that. But when things were, you know, erupting on scale like they did in Victoria, or and in the epidemics in Victoria, where I was located at the time. I was watching them very closely, and I watched these small and large epidemics emerge. All of those were not related to person-to-person spread directly. They were indirect person-to-person spread effects, but the eruptions, you know, the sudden appearance effects had nothing to do with person-to-person.
Hold that thought.
Very important. We've got to get that point clear, because I've got to explain what I mean by that. Go on.
Yeah, because it's such an important point, I want you to make it after the news headlines that we have to get to. So we'll get right into that on the other side of this. We're with Professor Ted Steele, everybody. A short news headlines, and we'll be back, because that is a super important thing that we need to touch upon here at TNT.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Here is the news.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. We're still no closer to a ceasefire in Gaza, with negotiations to secure a 40-day truce before Ramadan appearing to break down in Cairo. The US and British embassies in Russia have both released alarming security alerts, warning of imminent extremist attacks in Moscow. Beijing's once again warning countries against interfering in China's internal affairs. And Sweden officially became NATO's 32nd member on Thursday, ending 200 years of neutrality.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio, or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's News Talk. This is TNT Radio.
And welcome back to the program. We are with Professor Ted Steele. Sorry to interrupt you. You're on a terrific flow and getting to a very, very important point about the last 4 years. And I'll just let you remake that from scratch and carry on, Professor Ted Steele.
Good. Thanks, Dean. Yes, the PCR test was allowing, you know, detections of the spread of the virus right throughout the pandemic globally in all regions. And these sudden eruptions and these sudden appearances of pandemics, I won't have time to go into all the evidence for why I can justify why it wasn't person-to-person spread. It was because I just don't have time, but it's there in other interviews on TNT if people want to look. But the point is that the virus was striking from the air. There were airborne attacks, if you like, from the atmosphere of viral-laden dust, which was contaminating the environment. And when that happened anywhere, of course, when you think about it, people were rubbing up against the environment, whether it was the fur of their pets or railings on, you know, on the street or on the door, on the roofs of their car, and then accidentally touching their nose, or just habitually touching their nose, and of course that's it. They would catch an infection of a COVID-19. So that's environment to person spread, not person to person spread as the initial event. Now, this was so evident everywhere. It was really quite distressing and almost comical for me to watch all of our expert epidemiologists in Australia keep talking about rapid person-to-person spread as they were trying to explain all these epidemics in the different states. And it never happened that way. Now, I'll talk, if I've got time, I can talk where it originally came from. But that's very important, you see. It was in a contaminated environment that was giving the appearance of rapid person-to-person spread because, you know, And it stunned Daniel Andrews in Victoria because he clamped and locked down the place so heavily, yet he couldn't figure it out. He never dampened the curve. By the way, that never happened anywhere. There was no flattening the curve anywhere. That's because the environment was contaminated. And in Victoria, it was just comically obvious that all of the lockdowns, and they were severe in Victoria, never actually stopped person-to-person spread or the apparent appearance of it. In fact, the virus seemed to be going faster than the contact traces. It's because there were lots of spontaneous infections occurring of people rubbing up against the environment. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
The epidemiology is completely different to what we've been sold. Now, that's why any introduction of any sensitive test, which is not based on symptoms and then used to, you know, to enforce it by mandate and law, is just over the top in my mind. If we don't come to grips with the basic epidemiology of the origin and spread of COVID-19. Now, those who have been following me know that the simplest explanation for all of the phenomena around the world is that the virus, came in. It was a a life-bearing meteorite that delivered this virus over China in October 2019. And that strike, you know, the first viral atom dust, which is the dust that gets liberated after the meteorite, you know, before the meteorite explodes, right? But when we see the meteorite explode, the viral atom dust has already been liberated and it's floating down gently. So what actually happened there in China was that China got heavily contaminated right across the whole Chinese region and on the periphery, you know, South Korea and probably spill over into Japan. But the point is that if you look at the epidemiology of the cases in China, it was erupting at the same time. Now, that phenomena of eruptions at the same time occurred repeatedly throughout other major regions of the world. It occurred a year later in India, in a massive eruption across the whole, a continent, the subcontinent of India at the same time. And then another very important, now the reason I'm stressing these is because they show you that it wasn't person to person. It was happening too fast for it to be person to person. Because person to person is, one person catches it, grows the virus, if they're going to allow the virus to grow, and then a week later they pass it on to someone else. You see, that's the basic spread mechanism. But you see, these things were going up in hockey stick type eruptions all over the world when they actually took place. So we have to actually understand that it was a contaminated environment that was triggering all of these epidemics. Now, I want to give you a graphic one, and this was I don't have time to give you all of the reasons of where Omicron came from, but the Omicron was a plumed virus. That is, it was one of the variants from the pandemic that emerged in 2021, towards the end of 2021. And it was in the atmosphere. From our modelling, our interpretation of the evidence, it was clearly in the atmosphere, distributed globally. But then it was brought down suddenly by a solar pulse, solar weather, space weather event. So I want you to sort of envisage the simplest explanation for what we've observed globally is that there were clouds of viral-laden Omicron dust hovering in the mid to high atmosphere. And then at different parts of the world, totally disconnected, there's some sort of space weather, a solar pulse event, which brought all these particles to the ground at roughly about the same time, or ocean. And I just want to list to you now, I want you to take your mind back to the end of 2021 when Australia was fully vaccinated and the first few days of 2022 in January. That's when Omicron struck Australia with great force, okay? I want you to remember that period, late December, it's got Christmas time, 2021, into the new year, 2022. It was occurring simultaneously, like hockey stick curves, the curves that go up like this. Over the same days in South Australia, Victoria, New South Wales, Tasmania, Queensland, the island of Hawaii, Toronto, New York, Florida, UK, Netherlands, Denmark, many countries in Europe, many, many ships in the North and South Atlantic Ocean, cruise ships and US Navy ships. All those ships, of course, were all fully vaccinated. I've got to stress that. People were catching it, even though they were fully vaccinated. And then there were isolated regions in Antarctica that were all going to go down. The point I'm trying to make is all of these things happened so fast, there's no way anyone could argue the case that it was happening by person-to-person spread. So I'm giving you these graphic examples to illustrate, unless we get the epidemiology of these things right in our head, albeit for a common cold, a pretty harmless common cold here, so we're very lucky.
Yeah.
Then we're going to keep repeating these same crazy mistakes that we made with COVID. These flatten the curve lockdown mistakes could easily happen again, and the hysteria could easily happen again on the same scale we've seen. Another Daniel Andrews will emerge, another crazy premier like that premier in Western Australia will emerge, or the chief minister of the Northern Territory, Michael Gunner. These individuals, they will pop up again if we don't understand how this happens. So that's why I'm stressing the fact that throughout COVID, person to person was not the primary ignition of the epidemics. It certainly happened in nursing facilities and aged care, but think about it. In those facilities, we had immune defenceless elderly comorbid people that were replicating the virus to trillions of particles. They were breathing it out. They were splattering it everywhere. It was literally over everything. Anyone that entered one of those aged care facilities, a healthcare worker, a doctor, even if they wore protective clothing, they would have picked up these particles on anything that they touched in that facility. And in fact, all the evidence suggests that the reason that the big bonfire of the nursing homes in Victoria happened by healthcare workers innocently working across multiple healthcare facilities, you know, in nursing homes. And that's how it spread. And that's why we're up in such an eruption in Victoria.
Yeah, and of course, we all know people.
It's so important to get this right now. All of those, but I'm going to name them, all the epidemiologists in Australia who for almost 12 to 18 months were monitoring all of this and explaining it by person-to-person spread and advising governments got it completely wrong. No one will debate me on this evidence. And they're Raina McIntyre at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales, Catherine Bennett, who's leading the current inquiry into COVID by Anthony Albanese at Deakin University, Tony Blakely at the University of Melbourne, Michael Toole at the Burnet Institute and his colleague Brendan Crabb, Robert Boy and Paul Griffin. These were mainly on the edge of the epidemiology, but they were strong vaccine advocates. But all those people I've just named were also strong vaccine advocates. So we had crazy epidemiologists who got the epidemiology wrong, and they were also strongly advocating a vaccine that didn't work and was quite dangerous.
Yeah. Look, Ted, hold that.
Big mistakes.
Hold that thought, mate. We need to get to one more commercial break. We'll be back on the other side of it. But everything that you said makes a lot of sense, including I know plenty of people who literally were not going out, who caught caught COVID and hadn't been in contact literally with anybody. So it lends to what you're saying. We're back with Professor Ted Steele on the other side of this commercial break. This is TNT.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
America's greatest economic resource, our working age population, is at a dangerously low level and trending even lower. Birth rates today are 12 per 1,000, down from 14.2 in 2000, and less than half the 24.3 per 1,000 of 1950. Why is this dangerous? Well, the viability of Social Security, for one reason. We all know that there's no lockbox, that the government didn't put aside all those tax contributions that current retirees had paid into the system. No, it spent them as soon as it got them, requiring tax inputs from current workers to pay the benefits to today's current retirees. Fewer current workers, the more expensive those benefits become for the government. That's why we need immigration, but immigration is by definition a legal process. Come here through the front door, offer your education, experience, and expertise that will benefit the country. Sure, you'll receive benefits as well, but those are ancillary to the benefits that you provide to our nation. What we don't need are tens of millions of people here solely to crash our social services system. Come here to America, by all means, but come through the front door, not through the side door. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for today's News Talk, TNT.
Here's a bushfire fact. Bushfires can occur without warning. So if you're traveling during bushfire season, here are three simple steps to remember. 1. Check the fire danger rating before you go. The higher the fire danger rating, the more dangerous the conditions. It may be safer to replan your trip. 2. Think about the area you're going to and what you would do if a fire started. How would you escape the area if you needed to? And where would you go? Check if there's a neighbourhood safer place. 3. It's dangerous to drive through smoke or fire. If you can't find a way to avoid the fire, park in a cleared area, face the car towards the fire, and turn the engine off. Then lie on the floor and cover yourself to protect yourself from radiant heat. Live bushfire ready. For more helpful tips, visit myfireplan.com.au today.
This is the Dean Mackin Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And we're back with Professor Ted Steele, as somebody who is a qualified computer programmer. although I haven't done that for quite a few years, but the simple fact that I had an inherent understanding, as you would need to in that job, of numbers. And when you talk about things going viral or exponential, there is a certain pattern that one might expect when people are catching a what they are telling us was a highly contagious virus. And I was on the Worldometer website every day looking at the numbers, and the patterns weren't expanding the way one might expect, not even close. And everything that Professor Ted Steele is saying absolutely says I was right to understand those numbers couldn't be correct given what they were telling us.
Yes, that's right. And it's very, very important. And I was probably getting a bit forceful towards the end of that last section there, that, you know, it wasn't rampant, you know, person to person. It's because the error was such on a massive scale, and the government policy and public health policy was all based on it. I had to sort of go for it, you see. You see, it's also related to, Dean, the whole assumption between, you know, behind, you know, human engineered lab leak stuff, which is, to me, is nonsense. I don't have time to go through all the evidence that counters it, but I can go through this one in relation to person to person. You see, the whole principle of all those apparent sequences that they see in COVID that look interesting, you know, gain of function, which, by the way, crop up in many other viruses. It's not just COVID. It's these are natural phenomena. But the whole point of them getting all excited about the gain of function is that those sort of things could facilitate person-to-person spread, you know, cell-to-cell transfer. That's the whole point. So if it was engineered, now we get back to the fact that they've engineered the common cold as a bioweapon. And, of course, you know, that contradicts your whole, it upsets your headset about what constitutes a bioweapon. But anyway, the whole assumption with all these gain of function manipulations is that it's going to increase person-to-person spread. That's the whole point of it, isn't it, when you think about it? But it didn't happen that way. None of the epidemiology supports that. From every case that we look at right through COVID, let's just go back to the early few weeks and months of COVID. It was, you know, from our point of view, it came suddenly in that life-bearing meteorite in October the 11th, 2019, and all these subsequent events actually fit that. That was on the 40-degree north line over in northeast China. China, being the target country, got most of the viral laden dust first, but the rest of it was being distributed on the stratospheric 40-degree north line jet stream winds around the world. And many of the major epidemics, if you cast your mind back 4 years, were occurring after China. They were occurring in Iran. They were occurring in Italy. They were occurring in Spain. Then they were occurring in New York. There was a little bit of drift off that line in the first month or two, and it did in fact diffuse off the line, and then it moved down the Atlantic and moved into the southern hemisphere, into Brazil and other countries. But in those first few months, it was all hanging very tightly to the 40-degree north line. Now, don't you think, well, that's interesting, isn't it? How do you explain that? Well, our model of explanation actually explains that. So those two things are important. Now, there are lots of other phenomena that indicate that it couldn't have been happening by person-to-person spread, although the initial interpretation was that. Remember all the ships at sea in February 2020 that were being struck in the South China Sea, you know, the cruise ships? The Diamond Princess was one. That was a big one. That was the one that got a lot of publicity. The Westerdam was another out of Hong Kong. In both cases, the explanation was that infected passengers got on at Yokohama or Hong Kong. You know, so that's fair enough. The trouble is these ships, you know, were loaded with the immune defences elderly came over, you know, senior retirees having the cruise of their lifetime. So they're the perfect, unfortunately, they were the perfect target for this virus, because these are like floating Petri dishes. Anyway, but remember, if you think about those early months, there were other ships. There was a whole string of ships, actually, in around May 2020 in the North Atlantic and the North Pacific that were all coming down, and the South Atlantic, they were all coming down with COVID. And all of these, you know, fishing vessels or live animal transportation ships or, you know, ships that were all thoroughly tested by that point, because the testing regime was being mandated at that point. And nobody can understand why a ship that was thoroughly scrutinised and checked before it left port was suddenly going down with COVID. You know, a week or two out in the middle of the ocean. And that happened repeatedly. Look, I've got a whole list in front of me on the wall here of all the names of all the ships and the incidences. But think back to that. And the island of Sri Lanka was another case. Sri Lanka flatlined right until the 5th of October 2020. I think it was. Let me get my check that date right. Yeah, 5th of October 2020. Sri Lanka, right, next to India, that had already had just flatlining. And then on the 6th of October, it went straight up like a hockey stick. Lots of cases. Think about that for a minute. It couldn't have happened by person-to-person spread.
Sorry, go on.
Examples like this, you see. I could go through lots more examples, by the way.
Yeah, it's at the time, I just remember watching the numbers every day, and that world dominator site, it was something I was glued to on a daily basis, and it made no sense. But again, you know, all those people being on a passenger ship in the middle of nowhere, apparently not contracting it until they were on there, and person-to-person spread, it should have been this slow spread. A very small percentage of them would have been, they weren't on the boat for that long. It just didn't make sense to us lay people. And you found the missing piece of the
photographs.
Puzzle.
They're all hanging onto the rails, right, and looking, waving. They're all, and then they're touching their nose.
Yeah.
That's not spread on the ships. Look, another really peculiar thing that didn't raise any eyebrows at the time was, remember all the baggage handlers, that were, you know, at airport baggage handlers that were catching COVID? Remember that? A big one was advertised, you know, Qantas baggage handlers that Adelaide Airport for international flights coming in. They couldn't figure out why. Now, but that wasn't just localised to there. Baggage handlers were being victimised in other parts as well. And people that were why baggage handlers, for God's sake? Why are they somehow or other susceptible to COVID? You know, no one was critically looking at that. But look, the simple explanation is if you look at any airport where they're reeling out the trolleys to load all the luggage on the planes, they're exposed to the atmosphere. There's a bit of light rain. There's, you know, all those things could bring down, you know, the viral laden particles, and they could literally smother the outside of all of the, you know, the travel luggage. And it just gets, you know, shuttled into the cargo hold. Then at the next end, they get shuttled out again. And of course, the handlers are picking it up, touching your nose, catching coat, putting it on the conveyor belt. And the conveyor belt gets contaminated. So this is a much more sensible explanation for why baggage handlers and luggage was being contaminated, isn't it? Far more sensible.
Yep. And that's the thing. You just got to keep applying different models until you find something that fits. And every time you come up with these theories, I love them. Of course, they're all based on studies that you've done, but they always fit the narrative far, reality far better than their narrative. Yeah.
Yeah, the actual observations, and I keep insisting on that, and that's what drove us all along. We were anchored all the time in the actual observations. We weren't trying to, you know, none of their stories were fitting. And that whole collection of epidemiologists in Australia really helped feed the hysteria driven by the chief medical officers and the premiers. You know, that triumvirate of epidemiologists, premiers and the health officers, it was just crazy. It was just impossible for me to watch sometimes because they were just making absolutely insane decisions. Now we've got the terrible situation where Anthony Albanese's peak COVID inquiry is being led by Catherine Bennett, the epidemiologist that was making all these mistakes. Do you expect them to get to the truth in that inquiry?
No, absolutely. I've got a question, and I am asking you to speculate, but I mean, I can think of few people who could better speculate on this. I mean, had it not been for the lockdowns, had it not been for the mass fear porn campaign that we were subjected to, so if it was for none of that and we just all went through and about our normal everyday lives, contracted or didn't contract, you know, COVID, would we have even known there was, by today's definition, a pandemic? Because I don't want to go back to the 2009 definition of what a pandemic was, because they changed that dramatically.
Well, first of all, they had this test which they could test everyone all around the world so they could link all the tests to COVID, right? So that was the first thing they could do. And we never really had those widespread tests like we in the past. We had serology for picking up influenza pandemics in 57 and 68. But this simple test, widely available and applied by mandate, actually allowed them to track it all over the world. So that was the first thing. The trouble is, if it had happened without that detection things, it would have raised eyebrows. Yeah, there's a pretty bad outbreak of seasonal common cold going on everywhere around the world. That would have been the comment in yesteryear. And then, of course, and it's always known in aged care and nursing home facilities, the elderly are always vulnerable to respiratory infections, whether they're common cold or flus or respiratory syncytial virus, any of these things that upset their breathing apparatus in the lungs, because that's the portal of entry of all these infections, of course it's going to affect the vulnerable. So we would have noticed the vulnerable, you know, having respiratory problems. And yep. But in the past, we had to treat them with therapies, you know, which were done in a more logical way, not under the ambit of the lockdown hysteria that took place in Victoria, because that was just crazy, completely off the Richter scale and what they did. So yes, it would have been noticed, and it would have been noticed as a higher than normal apparent incidence in colds in elderly people and in the nursing homes. But I would have hoped they would have been looked after by things that the respiratory, you know, the respiratory people would know to use, like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, anti-inflammatories, antibacterials to suppress the bacterial infections. Anyway, you see what I'm getting at? There would have been therapies used, and it would have been less hysteria, I think. I'm not so sure, but certainly all those things fed it. And, of course, the drive to vaccinate was what was pushing the whole thing, wasn't it? In the early
days. It was scary. It was disproportionate. And we could go on. We've run out of time. Professor Ted Steele, yeah. I'd like to thank you very much for being my final guest here at TNT. Senator Malcolm Roberts got lost in the ether today. He's out on the road and he's uncontactable by phone. No signal where he is. But, mate, okay. Thank you very much for the multiple times you've come on to my program and here at TNT in general. Professor Ted Steele, thank you.
Thank you. And all the best, Dean. Thank you.
All right, Eli, just quickly, I want to thank management. They've been terrific. Mike and Jenny do a tremendous job and they work their asses off here at TNT. You know, I think they got served a bit of a shit sandwich by one of their investors towards the end of last year or the beginning of this year. And that's why it's really important for those of you who want to see them continue this important work. If you can, get on the website, make a donation to keep them doing what they do. I may be back one day. I've got off to do the IT work for a while. I really love you and I'll catch you all some other time.